life of a saint is a miniature world history. In the lives of most of these great leaders of mankind, there is a turning point which suddenly makes them put on a power and an outlook which for all outward casual look may appear to prepare a new personality altogether, as if the same person has been reborn. This is a new feature, a common, interesting, sometimes intriguing feature in the development of the process of the life of most of the greatest leaders of people. When I say leaders of people, I do not mean necessarily those whom you call saints. All astounding personalities, the vibhutis, those who strike a hallmark in the history of mankind, in any field of operation, it may be a remarkable military leader, it may be a scientist who has shaken the world of discoveries and inventions. It may be a literary genius. It may be a religious or spiritual leader. To appreciate this peculiar occurrence in supernormal personalities, we have to carefully study their own lives. It was the case with Saint Augustine, who wrote his Confessions, in which we have a record of the transformation that took place in him in such a way that he was just the opposite of what he was earlier. For 18 years, we say, Christ was not visible. He went away somewhere, and his mission started after that apparent invisibility of his person. A period, as it were, of a preparation of a new personality of what you are going to consider as the great Christ. So was even our well-known scientist and physicist Albert Einstein. A poor little nobody he was, as it were. Was rejected from every office as a poor mathematician and a not even mediocre scientist. The caliber of a mathematician like Srinivasa Ramanujan was not detectable to the naked eye. No one appreciated Shakespeare when he was alive. His plays were never read. He was an attendant in a theater, not a master that he is today. And many great personalities of this kind were born in families who are not normally recognized in human society. they may be born in the house of carpenters, shoemakers, or farmers. We rarely hear a master of this kind being born in the house of a business magnate, an industrialist, or a millionaire. It has not happened for reasons which anyone can imagine. In a similar manner, we read of a certain landmark in the great mission for which Master Swami Sivananda was born. The little that we know of his earlier days, he is just the knowledge we have of a seedling or a sapling, which when it is seen with eyes cannot be easily recognized as to what sapling it is. Is it going to grow into a banyan or a mango tree or some such thing, because it is just budding forth. When any event is to take place, it is prepared in its seed form as a nebular condition of a future action, a precedent condition in which it is not properly formed into the pattern in which it has to work later on. This preparatory precedent condition, antecedent to the form in which it has to work, is the condition through which every event has to pass, even if it be an illness, a sickness of the world, or a political revolution, a sudden windfall of fortune, and a bursting into a new outlook and discovery, or an invention in the field of religion or science. All great things are outcomes of sudden intuitions. They are rarely preparations by experiment, observation, and logical induction or deduction. It is a sudden burst, and we cannot compare it to any occurrence in the normal ways of the world. An awakening from a sleep, a slumber of potentiality. Though we may, for argument's sake, accept that the seed contains the whole tree in a latent form, that may be. But for all practical purposes, the great event which the life of a leader is cannot be adequately picturized in the earlier days of unrecognized and unknown preparation. So is the case with a leader like Mahatma Gandhi. There were days when he was not known. I am just mentioning the names of few well-known ones who appear to have a common procedure adopted for a common purpose to be achieved through totally differing channels of their modus operandi. A genius in medical science and a genius in literature are not actually doing two different things. Though it may appear that literary activity has very little to do with medical research or vice versa, The world works for a single purpose. It may employ different personalities and instruments in different ways for the fulfillment of its intention. It does not mean that there are freaks suddenly erupting into the daylight of human recognition, coming from nowhere and doing what one cannot understand. As I tried to mention earlier, there is a single operation going on in the whole world. And this has to be borne in mind by every one of us in order to understand life in its proper perspective. Though it may be very difficult for people to entertain such an outlook of carefulness and vigilant observation of the very process of thinking. Many things are happening in the world. This is what we read in papers. But only one thing is happening in the world really, an inner adjustment of its components. The personality of the world spirit, the time spirit, accommodates itself to the conditions necessary for the fulfillment of its purpose. So the latter part of the 20th century saw the sudden rising of luminaries in the firmament of science, political leadership, medicine, religion, philosophy, and literature. You have to cast a glance over the world history procedure for the last 50 years or 60 years or even back for 100 years. You will see what intense activity took place through the countries of the world in all the nations, and developments galore highlighted human history in many a future. The origin of rivers and the origin of rishis cannot easily be seen. Where the river starts, we do not know. And where the rishi or the sage or the saint started, also we cannot know. Rishi Moolam and Nadi Moolam cannot be known and is not supposed to be known also. The great line of reformers of a totally different nature started practically with the birth of the Ramakrishna Paramahamsa Deva in this century. And there was a continuous flow of the stream of this kind of work with a many-sided touch given to it. And we will be able to understand the meaning of this kind of all-round activity in which the world reveals itself only if we can become students, careful students of the cultural history of the world in the latter part of the century. The mission of all saints may look like a single performance of awakening the spirits of people to a consciousness of a higher life. That may be true. But different climes and times require variegated touches given to this single performance. And so a person born in Mecca, or one in Palestine, or one in India, may not necessarily adopt the same formation of procedure, though the procedure adopted may contain within its purposive activity the same force, because the mode of the application of this force of the rectification of any kind of irreconcilability within the earth as a whole should be so aligned that it fits in to the particular preponderating physical conditions, political conditions, social conditions, and may even have something to do with the ethnic characteristics of people. For instance, he has to speak in that particular language of the region in which he incarnates himself. Even language is a very important aspect to be considered in the activity of people, a language which they use as the instrument of their performance. The saints and the sages are also seem to be working in a very mysterious manner. For instance, we have cases where great masters led a single disciple forward, who became the torch bearer of the guru or the master. A single personality was prepared by this force that incarnated itself as a sage or a leader. But there are others who came for a general shake-up of the very structure of the world. This kind of work is not concerned with personalities. An awakening of the entire slumbering humanity. And not necessarily a work connected with groups of people or much less individuals, may be said to characterize the saint and the sage we are considering now, Gurudev Swami Shivananda Maharaj. If you are shaken up and made to see with your own eyes what things are there in front of you, if you have been helped to wake up from sleep and enabled to see with your own eyes, you know what is good for you. When you see what is in front of you with your own eyes, it does not require much of an effort on your part to do what is proper. And so he came to rouse people from a kind of sleep. People were asleep. Asleep to the spirit that is within and totally unconscious of their own souls, but intensely conscious of what is not so. There can be a sleep of a different kind altogether. Sleep is not necessarily a state of unawareness of things. It can be that, but it can be a worse thing than total unawareness. An awareness of what is really is there is one thing, and unawareness of what is really there is another thing. But what do you call the condition of an awareness of what is not there? That was the state into which mankind descends when it gets involved in the objects of the world. We may underline here that the world has no objects in itself. There are no objects in the world. There is the world, but there are no objects. You have to bring to your memory a little bit of what I said yesterday and the day before. There are no things in this world. There is no such thing as something being in the world. There is the world. And there is no in and out for the world. Hence, to be conscious of an object would be to characterize the knower of that object as an individualized location which has managed to consider itself as the center and the world as its satellite. There was a time when people thought that the earth is the center of the whole of creation and the entire solar system was moving around. This is what they call the Ptolemaic astronomy, which is now superseded by a later discovery. I am the center. Every observer, every seer, every perceiver, every knower considers himself as the center round which the whole of world operates, as a conglomeration of objects. The seen has a status inferior to the status occupied by the seer. This is partly a concern of psychology, whereby we can know how we place ourselves in a very comfortable position when we are observers and not the observed things. It is to be in a state of great discomfort to be observed. It is a great comfort to observe. If we can appreciate this point of view, none would like to be observed, seen, noticed, or handled, or made a thing of study. That would be to get converted into the status of an object, a thing, a satellite, something that is an associate without a status of its own. An observer, a seer, one who conducts an operation and investigates is always in a superior position compared to the position of that which is investigated. Now, are we observers of the world? Are we seeing it? Or is the world seeing us? We can never imagine that the world sees us. It looks as if we are seeing the world. But there is another aspect to it. When we speak of the world as an object of our perception, we include all people except oneself. All people around are the world. They are part of the world. The observer himself is not the world. Because to convert or place oneself in the position of an object would be to get deprived of the status of the observer and people began to get involved gradually in this dependence on what they considered as the objects of the world, to which I made reference yesterday as the outlook of materialism, a natural outlook which disbelieves it being possible at all to live in the world without being dependent on things outside. Our life seems to be a medley of a variety of dependences hanging on various factors for our security, a bare permission to exist. If sustenance is not to come to us from outside, we would not be alive. Is this true? If this is true, glory, all glory goes to crash material. All life is a product of the collocation of material forces. And all significance, all meaning and all value has to be attached only to the patterns and the formations of the constituents of matter. That this is not true. That the peculiar and uncomfortable status which the observer of things appropriates to himself and converts everything in the world into a lower status has a great meaning. Why is it that a seer or an observer should have the higher status? Though this is something into which we cannot easily conduct investigations, it is something which we have to accept. The reason behind this is the presence of a status in the observer. And at the same time, there being no such thing as an observed object. The automatic action that takes place within ourselves when we make an observation of anything, an action which bifurcates the seer from the seen and keeps the seer on a higher pedestal, the seen on a lower, this action has a super empirical connotation. It is not for nothing that you are made to feel in this manner. We are not people made up of material forces. We are not hanging on the mercy that is bestowed upon us by natural forces. Each person has a status of his own or her own. Therefore, dependence is not our birthright. Freedom is our birthright. No one can be regarded as free who is so dependent on factors externally. If our life is a dependence entirely on natural world forces, freedom is a chimera. No one can be free. It is impossible to conceive it even. But we ask for nothing but freedom. It looks as if we are asking for something which cannot be there. And yet it is the only thing that we are asking for. Freedom and freedom and freedom and nothing but freedom. You want to have a free hand in everything. This is what you ask. There are dogs lying down under the shades of trees. They will be lying down, snoring, sleeping, whole day. But you tie a rope around its neck and tether it to the tree. Leave it there to sleep. It won't like to sleep like that. Though you have not done anything, except that you have tied a rope. It has been lying there all day. And you have only tied that rope to the neck. It does not want it. It will go on whining throughout the day so that the rope will be removed. Because the freedom is limited. He is sleeping, that's all right, but why do tie a rope around my neck? I don't want it. So it whines and struggles and tries to break the rope. We do not want the pleasures of life. We want freedom. Pleasures minus freedom are pains only. It is status that everyone asks for, not riches. All riches and wealth minus status and recognition is like a husk. But why is it that we ask for freedom? What is wrong with us or right with us? These great leaders proclaim the great truth of this matter. Freedom is the birthright of everyone. And everyone is basically free. Nobody can be bound. There is no bondage. Really speaking, bondage does not exist. A kind of involvement of ourselves in situations which are inextricable and unintelligible produces a sense of bondage. We are not merely essentially free, we are told something more. We are also deathless. Both these statements are very hard things to understand. We do not appear to be free at all. We have got harassments from every side, troubles and problems and sorrows and nothing but these. Who is free in this world? But we are told you are basically only free. But everybody dies, and yet it is told that you are really deathless. These two highly intriguing proclamations seem to astound us. And it is so because even when we are conscious that there is a world, now for instance we are awake, but really we are sleeping in a different sense. As I stated, sleep is not necessarily a state of total unawareness. It can be something worse than that. Often, to be unaware is not so bad as to be aware of a totally erroneous situation. This is sometimes called, in the technical language of our philosophy, the avaranas and the vichepas, a clouding of consciousness and a projecting of consciousness. The clouding is the preventing factor which sees to it that you cannot know what is there. A thick veil is hung in front of your eyes. But a peculiar distorting lens also seems to be clutched to these covering veils, through which you are forced to see a distorted figure completely. That which is inside is thrown out and made to appear as an outside phenomenon. That which is really outside looks like a within. We are, as individuals, considering the story of creation we have in the Upanishads and elsewhere, we people are later products than the creation of the world. Individuality emerged afterwards. The whole world stuff was created earlier. It may be due to this reason that Sri Swami Shivananda Maharaj used to say the policy of our life should be that God is first and the world is next and we are last. We are last because we came the last. The cause is the world, we are the effects. Now the world looks like an effect for us and we are the cause. There is a topsy-turvy perception. In the Upanishads we are told that at the time of creation, in an epic language, we are told celestials fell headlong, upside down, with head down and leg up, as it were. This is how Lucifer fell and became a Satan in the biblical language, falling headlong he is not to be able to see naturally. An unnatural perception is world perception. To put it cryptically, that which is everywhere is made to appear as something which is outside. And that which was produced later, an effect, is given the position of a cause, and the cause appears as an effect. So, the philosophy of dependence of senses on objects arises as a natural consequence of this erroneous perception. This kind of sleep is a fatal blow to mankind as a whole. It is a hypnotization of the spirit. And in that condition, nothing that is said can be received. A hypnotized person is not a normal person. So, a person who believes in the value of this topsy-turvy perception cannot be instructed. Nothing can go into the head of that person. Because the mind of that person has decided to think in a completely erroneous manner, in the topsy-turvy fashion, and that fashion of perception determines the capacity to receive even. So even if a right thing is told, it will be received wrongly. Such was the condition of the world. Even today it is not far, far removed from this unfortunate condition of devaluing the spirit of life and valuing the unspirit, the Antichrist. Each one of us is a judge for himself or herself. In what manner do we appreciate things? There is a great joy when riches fall on our heads from the material sources of the world. To be dispossessed of material contents is regarded as poverty, while true poverty is the poverty of the spirit. Loss of self is true poverty. Gain of the world is not to be reached. But how do we think, even today, to gain the world is to be wealthy? And we forget here that we cannot gain the world unless we have lost ourselves first. The gaining of the world is a simultaneous loss of the spirit of man. The within has gone and got clouded in the dark operations of exterior matter, which we call the comforts of life. So, a worldly life is the death of the soul. And who is worldly? Let each one consider for himself. This outlook, which is what we call worldly, earthly, material, crass, earth-earthy attitude, had to be remedied by a medication which has to come from the spirit only. It is the spirit that has to heal itself. No material force can be a remedy for this illness. So spiritual leaders alone could be the saviors of mankind. If we believe that mankind is nothing but a society of souls and spirits and not an association of material bodies, the world, humanity is a family of spirits, kindred souls, and not the dancing of atoms. That cannot be called the world. This was to be brought to the notice of these slumbering souls, somewhere actually fast asleep in the unconsciousness spirit, and others were sleeping in the consciousness of matter. Both are types of sleep only. To be unconscious of spirit is one kind of sleep. To be conscious of material existence is another kind of sleep. One is called avarana, the other called vichara. Both are twin ailments of mankind. They are two prongs, as it were, of a single attack of wrong perception. The fork, as people sometimes call Morton's fork, which catches you from both sides. There was a minister to King Henry VII of England who was called Morton. He was a tax extractor. He used to apply a fork, an administrative fork. If he sees a very well-dressed person, he will tell him, it seems you are a well-dressed, happy, healthy man, rich man, pay the tax. What is the difficulty? This is the rate of tax. If he sees a poor person dressed in tattered clothes, you are pretending. You are a wealthy person. Don't pretend like this. Pay the tax. So anyway, you are caught. Either you look poor or rich, it doesn't matter. You are caught. This kind of double attack is called Morton's fork in taxation policy, which was adopted by Minister Morton during the reign of King Henry VII. So here is the Morton's fork of double catch of avarana and vikshepa. You are caught if you are unconscious. You are caught even if you are conscious. Because to be unconscious is bad. And to be conscious of the wrong thing is worse. And in what condition we are, let each one know. Man, try to place oneself in the proper position of self-investigation. For which gospel to mankind, Swami Shivananda had such sales came. ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेव वशिष्यते। शान्तिः।